So today I'll be discussing work that I did last year, mostly last year, with Alejandro Castro, Per Kraus, and Finn Larson. We did a sequence of papers in 2007, which we reviewed along with some related work from an article beginning of this year. Okay. So let me just give you a short outline of what I'll be talking about today. So I'll just begin with some introductory comments, motivation for my work, explain the physical setting in which we'll do our analysis. Also, I have to introduce some technical tools, which will be necessary. Then we'll move on to the real meat of the talk, which is to actually compute solutions in supergravity, which have been corrected by string theory. Then we'll get into where the physics is, discussing things like space-time singularities and small objects. And by small objects, I mean states which you can think of as being Planck size. These are gravitational bound states which you just really can't effectively describe in the classical limit. And then we'll have some closing comments. Okay, so let's begin our introduction. So you may have heard that people are interested in string theory for a number of reasons. Reasons that are very, very broad. But today I'm interested mostly in the aspect of quantum gravity, so I won't be talking about the LHC or particle physics. What's the purpose of quantum gravity? What will we do with such a theory? Well, there's a lot of conceptual questions that we have in gravity. This is a quantum gravity audience, so I don't think I have to belabor this too much. But Hawking introduced us to the information paradox, which introduces a tension between classical gravity and quantum mechanics. So we'd like to be able to make some statements about that. Classical gravity also generically has singularities in it. This is a generic feature of the theory, not something that you could just wish away by some physical ansatz. Instead, this is something that we have to deal with. There's many types of singularities. You have your cosmological type of singularity, which occurs in, say, FRW models that we use to describe the universe as a whole, or also in models that involve a big crunch, late-time singular behavior. There's singularities predicted to be in the interiors of black holes, which forming from gravitational collapse. And these are something we would also like to be able to resolve. And then there's also more exotic things, like naked singularities. The simplest example of a naked singularity would be if you just took the Schwarzschild metric and made the mass negative. That's clearly an unphysical thing to do. But there's also naked singularities which are supersymmetric. And supersymmetry tells us that these things obey most of the energy conditions that you would wish. So these are not pathological configurations of matter. So this is something that we should probably, that we want to deal with and not just wish away. So the negative mass Schwarzschild you would just throw out. But other there are other singularities that occur, naked singularities that occur when you seem to have good, well-behaved matter. And then there's also the possibility of microscopic black holes, which some people are excited about in context of LHC. But this is something that you can't really discuss in classical gravity. So we need to go beyond that and go into the regime of quantum gravity. String theory is a candidate theory of quantum gravity, so we should be able to contribute at least some partial answers because string theory is only partially formulated as yet. We won't talk about all of these topics, but we're going to focus on things that are specific to black holes, although we won't get to all aspects of black holes. So let me just remind you of some of the work that's been done on black holes and string theory. One of the great successes of string theory is that it provided a microscopic description of certain types of black holes. That story's not entirely complete. Let me just summarize some of the classic work. So superstring theories have low energy limits, which are described by supergravity theories. So you might have some 10-dimensional string theory, you consider it on a certain compactification manifold, and then you get a 4-dimensional supergravity. That's one low energy limit of a string theory. There are others, there's a whole family of various supergravities, and there are various string theory limits to obtain them. These supergravity theories have known black hole solutions, supersymmetric solutions, and you can use Hawking's argument to calculate the entropy of these solutions. But this is really a thermodynamic kind of argument. What you're not doing is going in and looking at all the ways that the black hole is configured at a microscopic level. You're really looking at its essentially macroscopic transfer properties to obtain this result. Now, in string theory, since you have string theory is a candidate theory of quantum gravity and has a number of well-defined objects at the microscopic level. And what you can do is compute the number of configurations of D-brains, or fundamental strings, or more exotic objects like NS5 brains or M-brains, which have the same asymptotic charges as some supersymmetric black hole. Now, this is a computation that can usually only be done at weak coupling, because that's where we have control in string theory, typically. But supersymmetry allows us to continue to finite coupling, because the results that you obtain for supersymmetric configurations are independent of the coupling, and you can extrapolate. You compare that with the supergravity result. That is the area of the horizon. But to do that, you have to take the limit of large charges. And this is because you're really comparing to a thermodynamic result. Supergravity could be considered the thermodynamic limit of some statistical mechanics. So you find that they match. Then you get tenure at Harvard. That is if you're Strominger and Botha, who had first done calculations of these types. Now, so some of us still need tenure, so we have to do a little better. Okay. So what do I mean by doing a little better? Well, supergravity, one would expect to obtain corrections. It's merely a classical theory, and you should have quantum corrections, or in the analogy I used before, statistical mechanics gives you corrections to thermodynamics. Those corrections are parameterized by finite size of the system, a finite number of particles of the system. So we should be able to do more than just reproduce the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. In the theory of quantum gravity, we should also have subleading corrections. Supergravity is merely the leading behavior. So we expect a sequence of higher derivative terms, like Ricci tensor squared, Ricci scalar squared, Riemann tensor squared, to the fourth, to the sixth, so on. Now, you can't compute these in supergravity, because, as we know, such theories are non-renormalizable. So unlike a quantum field theory, where you can compute the corrections from the two derivative level, provided new physics does not enter at the scale that you're looking at, we don't have that ability in supergravity. So we need to go to something which is an ultraviolet complete theory. String theory is such an example. And in string theory, there's, in principle, a definite set of calculable corrections. So our goal will be to investigate supersymmetric solutions to an effective supergravity. That includes the leading order string theory corrections. So how will this affect the entropy? Will this have any effect on singularities? These are the types of questions that we'd like to address. Along the way, we would perform some consistency checks on string theory itself. This program's been pursued in 4 dimensions successfully. I'd like to move on to what I consider another interesting regime, which is 5-dimensional supergravity. Are there any questions? Let me just introduce the context of 5-dimensional supergravity. So why 5 dimensions? Well, 5-dimensional gravity is a little richer than 4-dimensional gravity. So what do I mean by that? So I'm particularly discussing the context of supergravity, supersymmetric solutions. In 4 dimensions, you do not have single center supersymmetric solutions that have angular momentum. So if you want to have a supersymmetric solution with angular momentum, you have to have multiple black holes. But in 5 dimensions, we do have such objects. Also, we have magnetically charged string-like objects in 5 dimensions. This is qualitatively distinct in 4 dimensions, where a magnetic charge is point-like. There are more exotic solutions, the so-called black rings, that have non-spherical horizons. The horizons are S1 times S2 in this case. There's also even more exotic things, like the so-called black Saturns, where you have a black ring with a black hole sitting in the middle. There's no such objects in 4 dimensions. There's no such thing as a black ring in 4 dimensions. The horizons are required to be topologically a sphere. Also, we have 2 distinct classes of attractor geometries. It's a little bit of a technical point, but that is not distinct from having qualitatively different magnetic and electric solutions. Essentially, you have a magnetic attractor class and an electric attractor class. I'll mention more about attractor geometries and attractor mechanisms later. In 5 dimensions, we also have the Chern-Simons terms, which are qualitatively different from Lagrangians that are gauge invariant. So the action is gauge invariant with Chern-Simons terms, but the Lagrangian isn't. This introduces interesting features and is not distinct from the fact that we have black rings in 5 dimensions. Of course, people have discussed 5 dimensions in context with explaining our 4-dimensional world as well. So popular phenomenological scenarios, Randall syndrome, the old idea of Kaluza-Klein. So phenomenologically, people discuss, of course, 5-dimensional phases of nature as well. And one of the other things which will be very useful in what I'll be discussing today is that the solutions that are intrinsically 5 dimensions, like the string and the black rings, the ones that don't occur in 4 dimensions, have ADS3 factors in their near horizon geometry. And the ADS3 CFT2 correspondence is especially powerful because it has quite enhanced symmetry. And that will be useful later on. So the spectrum of the theory, I'm going to be discussing N equals 2, supergravity in 5 dimensions. The minimal spectrum is the metric or graviton, gravitino, graviphoton, which is an extra vector in the gravity multiplet. We could couple this to a bunch of other vector supermultiplets as well. These vector supermultiplets have a gauge field, moduli, and a gauge genus, some fermions. This index I just indicates which vector multiplet I'm talking about. I'll generically couple the many, couple the gravity multiplet to many such vector multiplets. A convenient formulation of this is to take the graviphoton and put it into an extra auxiliary vector multiplet. But if we did that, we'd have an extra moduli in gaugino, so we need to put some constraints. There's a cubic constraint which is placed on the scalars, that this cubic polynomial of the scalars is 1. CIJs, the CIJK will turn out to be couplings in our supergravity theory. They are symmetric in their indices, and they vanish when any of the two indices are the same. This whole structure is known as very special geometry, and many people have been interested in it for its own sake. I'm not going to get into it too much. But in any case, that's what it's known as. We also have to place a constraint on the Gugino. And in the end, we find the graviphoton, a certain linear combination of all of these vectors. So that was from purely five-dimensional viewpoint. This is something that we want to embed in string theory, or actually the duality frame that I will use is M theory, the 11-dimensional phase of string theory. There, the Kähler moduli, the scalars and the vector multiplets, are understood as the volumes of certain two forms on the collabial. So let me back up just a moment. I'm going to start with 11-dimensional M theory and compact by a 6-dimensional manifold, which the collabial freefold, to get down to 5 dimensions, get down to a 5-dimensional effective theory. And in that effective theory, the scalars are understood this way. The corresponding vector in the vector multiplets comes by wrapping two legs of the three form in 11 dimensions on this same two cycle. The total volume of this collabial is given by calligraphic N. Recall that calligraphic N is defined right here as this cubic polynomial. So actually, we are looking at a regime in which the total volume of the collabial is just fixed. This is a choice we make, a consistent choice that we can make, but you don't have to make this choice. The CIJK, those couplings that appeared in the cubic, are intersection numbers of the two cycles on the collabial, or that is, they're simply topological data of the collabial. Excuse me?
The overall volume modulus is not there, you're saying, in your formulation?
So what occurs is that the overall volume lies in a n equals 2 hypermultiplet in 5 dimensions, and the hypermultiplets are uncharged, and you can just set them to fixed values. If you're looking at black hole solutions, you don't want to complicate it. You have all these minimal scalars running around. So you just set them to some values. So it's a consistent thing to do. But if you wanted to, you could try to put some hyperscalar hair on these objects, but that's an additional complication. So M theory also contains non-perturbative objects, non-perturbative states, which are not entirely understood, but are known to exist, the M2 and M5 variants. In 11-dimensional supergravity, these are merely solutions, supersymmetric solutions to the equations of motion with point-like sources or localized source. But in the quantum theory, they become promoted to dynamical objects. When we go down to 5 dimensions, we could wrap such objects around our collabial in various ways that will preserve supersymmetry. And for example, you could wrap an M2 brain on one of the two cycles of the collabial, and you would obtain some point-like object in 5 dimensions, which is electrically charged under the corresponding gauge field. Also, you could partially wrap the M5 brain on a 4 cycle, leaving one non-compact direction in 5 dimensions. So you're left with a string which is magnetically charged. OK, so that was just the spectrum. Now I have to get into a little bit more technicality to discuss how we actually incorporate stringy corrections. Well, this is the M theory frame, so there is an extreme coupling.
Oh, okay.
I mean, infinity. Right. And then it's just not the proper language. There's no 11-dimensional Planck length, and the corresponding expansion parameter in 5 dimensions, 5-dimensional Planck length.
Yeah, but then
that weights the derivative expansion. But there's no strings.
But you generally one expects string loop corrections at higher derivative orders. And how do you propose to incorporate that in the setup?
Well, I'm going to describe how we obtain what the corrections are in 5 dimensions, but I won't need to do a string loop computation. I'll need to do some quantum computation, but it won't really be a string computation. It's an M-theory computation. Okay, so the previous discussion of the spectrum is for on-shell supersymmetry. That is, all of the supersymmetry transformations of these fields, they only close, the supersymmetry algebra only closes up to the equations of motion of the theory. And so that means if I want to add higher derivative corrections, I would also have to correct the BPS conditions. An off-shell formulation would be useful because I wouldn't have to do that. If I had an off-shell formulation, supersymmetry and BPS conditions are purely representation theory. They don't have anything to do with dynamics. And so they're unaffected by the form of the action. And in particular, the BPS conditions are as complicated at fourth order as they are at second order. And the order I mean is the order of derivatives. So that would be useful to have if you want to add higher derivative terms to your analysis.
This is actually a follow-up to his question. What is the argument that tells you that the higher derivative entropy is independent of the volume of the compact manifold? I mean, that's crucial, right? Because you're setting it to be some fixed number, and that's like assuming that your entropy is not going to depend on this fixed number.
I'm not sure it has to be. I mean, it might be independent of that volume, but I don't think it has to be, because this is a solution that I can study. I can study a solution where the volume is this, and then I can compute its entropy.
The volume is a dynamical field. How are you guaranteeing that the equation of motion for that is satisfied?
Well, because its equation of motion is just like the Klein coordinate equation, except it's masses. I mean, it's a minimally coupled to gravity, chargeless field. In this sense, so the language is usually that it decouples, but it really means you can set these fields to some fixed value and then ignore them from then on.
That's usually only at the supergravity level, right? Everything that you said is at the level of 2 derivatives, and the questions are about higher derivatives.
Right. Now, I haven't told you anything about how I've gotten the higher derivatives, so these questions are kind of premature, I think.
No, but it's an important question, because the volume of the compact manifold affects the entropy. That's a fact. It's not maybe. It does affect. It will renormalize you the, you know, 5-dimensional Newton's constant, that will count as an entropy.
I'm not denying any of these facts. I just think these questions are premature. In a couple slides, we can talk about this again. So, where was I? OK. This is actually a clue to what we'll be doing. So once you have an off-shell formulation of supersymmetry, you can directly construct the Lagrangian, just because you know how to make supersymmetric invariants. And so we'll construct the Lagrangian directly in 5 dimensions, and then argue that we couldn't have added any more corrections to that order. And then these questions that you're asking are kind of moot, because we just argued we can't add any more terms at that order. There's nothing else you can invent. Another use for the off-shell supersymmetry is it allows a very natural way to fix the field redefinition ambiguity, which always exists in higher derivative theories, because you can simply say, shift the metric by the Ricci scale, by the Ricci tensor, or other higher derivative objects. You wouldn't do such a thing if you had a purely two derivative theory, but if you had, say, a four derivative theory, it would be natural to do this, and so your coefficients are kind of ambiguous. We use the form of the supersymmetry transformation, though, to fix what we mean by our field def, our fields. Now, how would we obtain an off-shell formulation? Well, this is fairly technical, but what one does is begins with five-dimensional conformal supergravity. This is a totally off-shell theory, but it has far too much symmetry. The supersymmetry that you get when you compactify string theory is Poincaré supersymmetry, not conformal supersymmetry. So to deal with this, you throw in a couple of compensator fields. These are unphysical fields that you use just to break certain symmetries. This is essentially a gauge fixing process where you choose a gauge where those symmetries are all no longer manifest. And the end result is some Poincaré supergravity with physical but extra fields, extra auxiliary fields, that you have to add for the off-shell formulation to be complete. So more specifically, the off-shell multiplets, we have the Weyl multiplet. This is what they call the gravity multiplet in conformal supergravity. You have the graviton, which I've written as a field beam here, gravitino, an auxiliary two-form field, an auxiliary fermion, and an auxiliary scalar. And the vector multiplets are much the same with a vector, a scalar. Gaugino. These have certain supersymmetry transformations around the bosonic background. So I'm setting all the fermions to zero here. These are the variations of the fermions around those backgrounds, epsilon being the supersymmetry parameter. And the point is, since this is off-shell, these variations are valid to every order in the derivative expansion. And the BPS conditions are simply setting the right-hand sides to zero. So we won't have to correct that to any order. So you can construct an invariant, a two-derivative invariant, Lagrangian, just by combining multiplets. This is what you get. To obtain your conventional on-shell description, you integrate out the auxiliary fields, the extra fields. The scalar D, we see it's just a Lagrange multiplier, which enforces the condition n equals 1. That is something that's enforced by hand in the on-shell theory, but here it comes out as an equation of motion. And we see that this auxiliary field VAB turns out to be roughly the field strength for the graviphoton. It's a certain linear combination of all the field strengths of the vector multiplets.
So that's the question, right? So now
no.
You construct. Yes.
No. This is the two derivative
approach. Now you are explicitly constructing the action in such a way that it imposes a condition n equal 1. And that's saying that the
multiple. No. Supersymmetry enforces that n equals 1. So constructing a supersymmetric action enforces that n equals 1. I didn't choose an action so that n equals 1. It's rather that the supersymmetry invariant that you construct will have an equation of motion so that n equals 1.
And the golden rule of Michael Abel is fixed at this stage or not?
At this stage, when you integrate out D, it will become fixed.
Okay, so why is so I guess my question is very simple. Why does the supersymmetry fix the volume of Calabi-Yau fixed? Is there some physical reason? I mean, usually we have the overall Calabi module, right? So the volume of Calabi-Yau can be anything we want. Now you are telling me that, you know, in this particular type of configuration, somehow it's getting fixed. I'm asking what the physics that fixes the volume of Calabi-Yau.
I mean, it gets enforced by supersymmetry. I need to construct a supersymmetric Lagrangian for my off-shell multiplets. The one I construct that has the right coefficient for the Einstein-Hilbert term, one of its equations of motion automatically enforces n equals 1. Maybe I'll stop answering this question if I just tell you that when I add the higher derivatives, there are no higher derivatives yet.
But with the new higher derivatives,
If I add higher derivatives, n does not equal 1 anymore.
Okay. He's not considering coupling to hypermultiples. That's why the volume is 1.
So it's fixed in that case.
Yes.
But why?
The volume will not equal 1 when I add higher derivatives.
Right, but so he chooses.
And you will see this
is coupling to a hypermultiple.
Yeah, yes.
So that's why my question is why. So there is a construction of a two derivative Lagrangian, but that's not the most general one.
I think it's a coupling only.
This is not the most general. Well, so there's been some gauge fixing done here. So we start with the Lagrangian and the conformal theory, and we have to do some gauge fixing to get down to the Poincaré theory. Mm-hmm. And that could generically, and there's generically a kinetic term, but it's consistent to just have that match. I mean, this is just a consistent. This is a consistent story. I'm not saying it's the most general story. But also, what we'll see when we actually get to the higher derivative terms, we'll see that n does not equal 1 anymore.
That's fine. But in principle, this condition of my question doesn't make sense.
Okay. So this is just the two derivative story. And when I say this is two derivative, you have to understand that certain terms explicitly have two derivatives, like the Ricci scalar. These auxiliary fields you have to sort of assign a derivative weighting to. So V is derivative weight 1, D turns out to be derivative weight 2. When we assign that weighting, we can have a consistent notion of a derivative expansion. Now the higher derivative corrections are where all the action is supposed to be here. And so you can construct a higher derivative Lagrangian by just doing the same thing that you do for the second derivative Lagrangian. You just try to find a supersymmetric invariant, which has four derivatives in it. This was done by Hanaki, Ohashi, and Tachikawa in late 2006, I believe. And the particular action that they find is the supersymmetric completion of a certain mixed gauge gravitational Chern-Simons term. This is just A wedge R wedge R, A wedge trace R wedge R. Excuse me?
Well, if you want to make the most general supersymmetric Lagrangian, how many terms do you have to consider four derivatives with all these fields compared to, say, two derivatives?
Well, so we think that the supersymmetric completion of this is the most general one. There's not a proof at that four derivative order. And the reason why we think it's that is that no one can find any other four derivative supersymmetric invariants in that formalism.
So this is
most general.
Okay.
Or it's thought to be most general, but there's not a proof. So what makes this term interesting is you can actually calculate its coefficient in the microscopic theory. So this comes from a calculation for 5 grains in 11 dimensions. So you know precisely what that coefficient is going to be, and that supersymmetry tells you what all the other terms are, fixes their relative coefficients. So now you have a very definite set of four derivative terms with the coefficients. So we use this Lagrangian of Hanaki, Ohashi, and Tachikawa, instead of computing every term in M theory and dimensionally reducing, because we couldn't have done that anyway. That would have been far too hard, and we don't really have the technology. But this anomaly term is special, it's calculable. We can trace it down to 5 dimensions and then supersymmetrically complete.
So, can I just clarify? So, you're talking about the C3 versus S8 term in M theory,
I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
You're talking about the C3 like x8 term in theory.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that when one considers potentially reducing on a Calabrial, you just get that. Is that right?
Right, with very specific alpha I, very specific coefficients. Well, that's not precisely it. I think most misspoke. I know exactly what this coefficient will be in five dimensions. I don't really care about anything else. I just completed my supersymmetry at the level of five dimensions. So I only trace one term. That anomaly term will lead to other terms, but I don't trace all of them. I just follow this one and then use supersymmetry to complete it, and then find that we have such a hard time coming up with more Lagrangians of that order that maybe it's impossible, so we just move on and try to compute black hole solutions. Yes, Alex?
So this might not be directly relevant for your talk, but maybe you can help me here. So this, the term of this type comes in M theory, right? So at least we see it in M theory. It involves a gauge field, right? I mean, after you reduce it to five dimensions.
In five dimensions, gauge field, yeah.
So is there a way, can you imagine backgrounds in type 2B, so thinking in terms of some key duality you will do on your Calabrial, and is that something that will produce?
I've thought about these things, and it's very hard. You're trying to get to ADS5?
I don't care what it will be. I just want to know, well, first of all, I see a vector field, so is there a way of, what would be if somehow I would need to do a key dual in a compact in this color VR and then interpret it as a type 2B background?
I've definitely thought about trying to understand this in type 2B because I'd like to do ADS5 calculations which would be relevant to ADS5's CFT. But I don't have the answer yet. Otherwise, I'd be talking about that. But I don't have the answer to that yet.
So in N-theory, we know that there are R to the 4 terms as well. And when I compactify those down on a Calabrial, I would expect those to contribute as well.
I'm not saying those terms don't contribute.
But I thought you were saying that you're working with an action which is just a supersymmetric completion of this guy. So is
right, but it involves a lot of auxiliary fields. So being able to trace exactly how those auxiliary fields are connected to some 11-dimensional thing is not completely clear. What I know is there is a term like this, I can complete it by supersymmetry, and then I can find it doesn't seem like I can add anything else at the level of n equals 2 supersymmetry.
Okay.
So I'm just kind of agnostic about a lot of these questions.
So the assumption is that once you lift it to M theory, you would see the R to the 4 term as well, presumably. Is that right?
Are you talking about an R to the 4 term in 5 dimensions?
No, in 11 dimensions.
Oh, in 11 dimensions. Okay. Yeah, so that will contribute to some of the terms, and let me just bring up the higher derivative Lagrangian.
Yeah,
so this is the 4 derivative Lagrangian. So you'll see that the R squared terms are not just A wedge R wedge R. You also have the Biot tensor squared. These are kind of effectively R squared terms because these are auxiliary fields. When you use their equations in motion, they will have some component from the metric. So you see this is very complicated. There's many contributions that come from many different things that we can't trace all the way back to 11 dimensions. We have power over this term because of anomalies in supersymmetry. And what we have in particular is that in suitable units, I think this is five-dimensional Planck mass is like pi over 4. I'm sorry, I didn't post my units. This is the coefficient, where these C's are integers and different topological data of the Calabrial. So at the two-derivative level, the topological data from the Calabrial that enters is just the intersection numbers. Here you also obtain second Chern classes.
Is it invariant and just the lowest order supersymmetry transformation, or are you modifying the supersymmetry transformation rules as well? Or did they?
No, the supersymmetry transformations are off shell. They don't get affected by higher derivatives.
Okay.
So it's the same supersymmetry transformations I showed earlier. They don't get more complicated.
Sorry. So in this case, the supersymmetry is really crucial, right, in this concern.
Supersymmetry is very crucial in this construction. That the theory is supersymmetric. I mean, once I have this theory, I can try to investigate non-supersymmetric solutions.
Well, that's exactly the way I'm leaning. So strictly speaking, you can look only on the supersymmetric solutions, right? So you don't know whether that would be a consistent truncation in a non-supersymmetric set.
No, if the theory, I can only look at compactifications that are supersymmetric. But once I'm down to five dimensions, I can look at a non-supersymmetric black hole.
Okay,
so because
we can talk later, but that's not always possible. I mean, usually that's the question that I was asking.
Okay, perhaps there are subtleties, but I can't. I don't have much to say, and also I'm going to look at supersymmetric solutions.
Okay, good. And now the second, very quick second question. So if I turn off all the gauge fields, what will happen with this? What derivative event? What terms will be left? Are you this wild square term?
Well, if you turn off all
gauge fields,
all the V's should vanish too. Well, I'm not certain, but all the V's might vanish as well.
The V's don't have like reach tensors and things like that.
Well, so at the two derivative level, their equations of motion make them proportional just to the field strengths. But the point is that the V equation of motion is very difficult at this level. We haven't really analyzed it.
Okay.
What's nice about the off-shell formalism is we get to avoid equations of motion as much as we can and actually get somewhere. So in actually obtaining solutions, what we're going to do is avoid the equations of motion as much as we can, because that four derivative Lagrangian is terrible looking. And instead, since we're looking at supersymmetric solutions, we rely mostly on the BPS conditions. So strategy, much like you do at the two derivative level, you make some ansatz with desired symmetry properties. Supersymmetry turns out to imply that there's a causal Killing vector, certain bilinear of the Killing spinners. So the analysis splits into time-like and null cases. The Killing spinner obeys a certain projection, which means these solutions are all half BPS. Now we solve the supersymmetry conditions. This is all independent of the action. Solve the Gravitino variation, tends to, in the cases that we've looked at, eliminate this auxiliary field. Gaugino variation determines the gauge fields in terms of moduli and other fields. The auxiliary fermion, which I call the Auxino, ends up eliminating the field D. And then you solve some equations of motion as necessary to fully specify the ansatz that you've chosen. The equation of motion for D is not that tough, because you see that it only appears algebraically here. So the D equation of motion, we're not afraid of using. And this gives a constraint on the scalar moduli space, which is not n equals 1, because D appears in the higher derivative Lagrangian. So n equals 1 plus corrections now. We usually need to look at the Maxwell equation if we're looking at electrically charged solutions. That will relate the moduli and metric functions to the values of the electric charges. For magnetically charged solutions, we don't even have to look at the Maxwell equation. We can get away with looking at the Bianchi identity, which doesn't even get corrected by higher derivatives. And we want to avoid Einstein equations and the V equation of motion, like the plague, because they would clearly be the most complicated. The gauge fields only appear linearly in this, but V appears all over the place, up to quartic powers. Einstein equation would clearly be a mess too. So if we can, we will avoid using them.
You put down something which looks good to you, and you check that it solves all these equations, and you say, good, fine. So what's your strategy here, since you're not going to actually go through all the equations of motion?
Well, usually what you do is you write down an ansatz that is consistent with some symmetry. What spherical symmetry, say? Okay. Now that doesn't really tell me what the metric is. It just tells me the metric has a number of functions which depend only on certain variables. So then I go and I look at, say, supersymmetry conditions. This will put constraints on those functions in the metric. Now, if my ansatz was constraining enough, if there were few enough undetermined functions in the ansatz, then supersymmetry and a small amount of equation of motions might just constrain all of them.
So your strategy is your
And then you can just check, say, on some Maple or Mathematica that the other terrible equations are solved.
Okay, so you actually do that at the end?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Okay, so an example solution is the black hole. It's a electric black hole. Let me go through this pretty quickly. I'm kind of running a little over time, I think. So you have spherically symmetric ansatz. The Killing spinner always satisfies a certain projection. In this case, it's this. The supersymmetry conditions end up eliminating the auxiliary fields and telling me that these undetermined functions in my metric are related like so. Also, they determine the gauge field in terms of the moduli in the metric function. And these results are valid regardless of the Lagrangian. But I still need to know what the moduli are and what that metric function is, so I have to go a little further. So I investigate Maxwell's equation, which is affected by correction since it's an equation of motion. Nevertheless, it yields a pretty nice form. So technically, this is a four derivative equation of motion, but it's a total Laplacian. So that's very useful and is presumably due to the fact that it's supersymmetric that it is organized so simply. In this case, I've defined a new variable, m with a lower I, as a certain quadratic function of the moduli. So this is solved by a harmonic equation. M infinity and q are constants. Q is interpreted as the electric charge. M infinity is a boundary condition on the moduli, or boundary value of the moduli. And then we have to supplement this with the D equation of motion, which modifies the special geometry structure. So now n does not equal 1 anymore. And instead, has fairly complicated dependence. A little bit of a typo here, should be another parentheses. And so now, given some q and m infinities in these harmonic functions, you have to just solve the system numerically. So that's just an example solution. What's a little bit more interesting are the magnetic solutions, the strings. They're obtained similarly, except that the Killing spinner now obeys a light-like projection. That is, it's null. The associated Killing vector is null. These are magnetically charged, so we can use the Bianchi identity instead of the Maxwell equation, which is much simpler. Again, the solutions are determined by some harmonic functions. Here's your metric with some metric function u. Field strengths are the magnetic charges times the volume form of the unit sphere that enwraps a string in five space-time dimensions. The moduli are determined. Simply. And then finally, we have a complicated equation for the metric function u. Again, given some numbers, we can solve this with Mathematica or Fortran or whatever you like. But it would be nice to have some exact solutions to analyze. So a standard aspect of supersymmetric black holes is the attractor mechanism, that the near horizon regime has enhanced supersymmetry and a specific type of ADS times sphere geometry. The scale of that geometry is determined by the charges. And the moduli, even though they have arbitrary conditions at infinity, their near horizon values are also determined by the charges of the solution. So we'll just assume a solution of this form. This turns out to be ADS 3 times S2, and put back into my previous ansatz. And also, since I'm considering near horizon, I just set sorry. I just set these m's to 0 just for convenience because I'm at very small r. And this turns out to be the exact solution if the ADS scale is given by this polynomial in the magnetic charges. So here we have an exact attractor solution to our corrected equations, even though we had to address the black holes numerically. So if I wanted to, say, match this onto some asymptotically flat solution, I would have to, again, go to numerics. OK, so now what I want to do is talk about singularities and small objects, particularly in the context of these strings, which I just brought up. So we found that the scale of geometry is given by this polynomial in the charges. But it's quite possible that this term, the cubic, simply vanishes. We call these small strings because these would have zero size if I didn't have the corrections. So remember that the fourth derivative Lagrangian had this ci as its overall coefficient. So the corrections are more or less parameterized by ci. So without that, without this correction, this geometry would be totally singular if this cubic vanishes. It could vanish, for instance, if I had less than 3 distinct non-zero charges, because recall that if 2 of the indices are the same, the c's vanish. So such solutions are nakedly singular leading order. So you go into this solution, and you go near to this solution, and it's not an ADS. It's zero size space. It's just singular. The whole thing breaks down. So naively, it looks like the correction term simply smooths out the singularity, because because even for a single charge, I still have a non-zero contribution to this size. Now, I said naively because near singularities, the derivative expansion should break down. So this formula should not be valid, actually, when I'm near a singularity of a two-derivative solution. So here we move off in a slightly different direction and appeal to ADS-CFT.
So when you set an exact solution, so you have a Lagrangian which involves just 2 derivatives, right?
I'm sorry?
2 derivatives plus a correction.
Yes. Right?
So when you say exact solution, that's exact solution of that Lagrangian.
It's exact solution of that Lagrangian. And so the point is, when there's singularities, that Lagrangian is not that.
No, that's fine. But yeah, I'm just curious because, you know, usually high derivatives come with small parameters. And so when we talk about solutions, we might talk only solutions up to this given order. So you are saying that if I look, suppose somebody would give me, let me rephrase my question. If I take your corrected Lagrangian and assume that that's all what it is, what is the solution that you are presenting, exact solution of that Lagrangian?
Yes.
Okay.
So the reason why ADS-CFT is so useful is that you can get what I'll call a non-renormalization theorem for certain quantities. So ADS-3 has very powerful symmetry. The bulk symmetries are SL2 times SL2, but they get promoted to an infinite dimensional Virasoro symmetry at the boundary because conformal symmetry in 2 dimensions is so big. There's also a lot of supersymmetry. At leading order, we find that the central charges of this dual CFT are related to the ADS scale. And so we're going to use central charge as a proxy for geometry. Due to things like field redefinition ambiguities, when you go to higher derivative level, higher derivatives, the notion of the geometry becomes a little little less well-defined, but the central charge is always a very well-defined quantity. So we'll concern ourselves with that. A careful treatment of anomalies in ADS-3 cross CFT leads to the C extremization theorem, which the average of the left and right moving, left and right central charges is obtained by extremizing a certain combination of the scales of the geometry and the Lagrangian. This would be the full Lagrangian, including all corrections. And this is just morally equivalent to the equations of motion solved for an ADS3 times S2 ansatz. Very similar to Sen's entropy function formalism in four dimensions. So for ADS spaces, this is exact. It's valid for all Lagrangians. So my Lagrangian here is not a leading order Lagrangian. It's any Lagrangian I want. If I apply that to the magnetic attractor, which I've been discussing, I get this is my central charge. And this matches the known central charge for CFT for the CFT for M5 brains wrapping on Calabi-Yau threefold, first studied by Malvasino, Strominger, and Witten. And so the argument here is slightly weak, but we find that higher order terms must not contribute, because we've now found the exact result known from microscopics.
Is this
related to an anomaly? It's, no, it's not surprising, but it's not a theorem. So a particularly interesting example of a small string is the fundamental heterotic string. This can be obtained fairly easily in R formalism because if you let R Calabi-Yau be a Calabi-Yau enhanced holonomy, which some people wouldn't call a Calabi-Yau, but a T2 times K3, that gives you certain values for the Chern classes and also certain constraints on the intersection numbers. If we consider N M brains wrapping just the K3, we obtain a central charge, 18 times N. But this configuration is dual to N heterotic strings in a T5 compactification of heterotic. That's due to what's called the heterotic type 2A duality in six dimensions. The central charges you would expect for a heterotic string would be 24 times N on the left, 12N on the right, whose average gives you 18N. So this is a nice consistency check on our work. Okay, so we found for the heterotic string, we have this ADS factor. And maybe we should think about holography. This would be a qualitatively different kind of holography. Let me go into some of the details. On the gravity side, the geometry is string scale. Recall this is a small solution. The leading order term, the p cubed part of the central charge vanishes. This is a small solution. So even though I argue that the central charge is something that we computed exactly, in general, we're not going to get everything. We couldn't compute everything exactly. So you actually have to use string theory. So we need to have all of the alpha prime corrections if I wanted to compute some generic quantity. So my gravity side is really string theory. I can't limit it to supergravity. But I can make it arbitrarily weakly coupled because it turns out that the string coupling in that frame decreases with n. So the gravity side at large n will be classical string theory. So this is sort of like a CFT-CFT duality because my gravity side is described by a world sheet CFT with a critical central charge. That is, I do string scattering amplitudes in this background, perturbative string amplitudes. They're not precisely scattering, but I have well-defined amplitudes. But of course, this is dual to a CFT that lives at the boundary of ADS3 that has all of the full quantum gravity. And so there should exist a regime in which both of these are manageable. Because if I have this CFT of this geometry, then I can I'm able to compute it to arbitrary order in alpha prime. So unlike, say, the most famous example of ADS CFT, where you can't really compute anything in the same regime, although sometimes you can compare things due to supersymmetry, this you'd be able to do some computations on both sides of the duality in the same regime, which would be a very unique test of ADS CFT. Unfortunately, this turns out to be extremely hard. So when you try to guess what these, by guesswork, figure out what these CFTs are, the world sheet CFT and the dual CFT, you run into these objects, nonlinear affine algebras. These all have unitarity issues. It doesn't seem that any of these actually have unitary representations. So there's a huge mystery now, and the status of this whole project is unclear, but I think is extremely interesting. So let me close. We have other solutions, which I didn't mention. We can add rotation. Also, the four dimensions, four space-like dimensions, I could have a more general metric than I had for the spherically symmetric black hole that I showed you before. This metric is constrained to be hyperkähler. An interesting example is Taub-Nut that interpolates between 4 and 5D. We can compute entropy for all these solutions, but there's currently not microscopic models for them all, so there's not necessarily anything to compare with. But in some sense, we have predictions for what you should see in these microscopic models, or maybe tools to help you build those microscopic models. Small black holes, though, unlike the small strings, turn out to be very problematic because their near horizon structure is ADS2 times S3, and the ADS2 CFT duality is, let's say, shaky. The future directions, asymptotically ADS5 solutions would be interesting. This requires using a gauge supergravity. This is not the formalism I use, but it's a little twist that is easily added, and this is a work in progress. We could perhaps make some interesting statements about the dual gauge theory. Also, there's an interesting naked singularity in that's asymptotically ADS5, the superstar. This would be interesting to see if we can smooth this out. There's also the NSP system. That is a string with carrying momentum along its length. That's another work in progress. That turns out to be a lot of work because, at least at the second derivative level, you use the Einstein equation. The Einstein equation also to fix this extra undetermined function that you have to add to the metric. That seems to be what you need to do in the higher derivative case as well, but the equation you get, I haven't been able to solve. It's pretty messy. It's not a total Laplacian like we found for other functions. But this would be interesting because we then have a small black hole in four dimensions, but since it's really a string in five dimensions, it's controlled by this ADS3 logic. The black ring would also be very interesting. This is work in progress. Again, very hard because now you need to appeal to one of the difficult equations of motion. It would be interesting if we could look at things like cosmological singularities, but this is non-supersymmetric, very difficult. We might try some kind of toy cosmology with a null time, but again, this would just be a toy. It's not really clear if you get anything interesting out of that. F-string holography, the fundamental string holography, this is work in progress by many groups. There are various proposals by various authors, but the status is pretty unclear now, I think. So just to conclude, we found the off-shelf formalism very useful. Essentially, we couldn't do any of this work without it. It allows us to construct the 5D theory, the actual corrections that we want. Vital for finding supersymmetric solutions. The question is, can we look at, say, non-supersymmetric solutions? It's not known if that's technically feasible, and I think Alex is suggesting there might be conceptual issues with that. We've seen one example of singularity resolution for the small string. Even though we can't keep a controlled expansion, ADS-CFT, the symmetry of ADS-CFT suggests that we have found an exact resolution of that singularity. And so I just want to leave you with the statement that 5D gravity seems to be a very interesting laboratory for questions in gravity. It complements our understanding of things in four-dimensional gravity. And of course, it may also be of phenomenological relevance. And so studying 5D phases of nature, I think, is a pretty interesting thing to do. Thank you.
On your simple charge argument, okay, I don't really have a good full expansion from derivative perspective, but I think this should be any. At least for me, I would worry that, well, maybe there are hybrid things which haven't had the same extreme. Do you have some intuition or argument that it can happen, or?
Could you say that again? Maybe rephrase it, I'm not sure at point.
So you said, okay, and what is the four derivative thing? It has the right simple charge, so people believe it should go. Okay. At least I would worry there might be other things with six, eight, any number of derivatives which happen to have the same extreme and the same center of charge.
I don't see why that's inconsistent with the notion this computation we did is exact. Well,
if there are other I thought the argument was it matches. So therefore, there can't be any kind of reason with the hybrid. But if there are other things which match your test just as well, then how is it controlled?
Well, I mean, the expansion is not controlled. I'm not suggesting that it is at a singularity. I mean, generically, there will, of course, be higher order terms if they contribute and string and this story is consistent, then that must mean that they have to cancel amongst each other.
Well, I'm not sure why. Well, maybe we should follow that for a bit. I'm not sure.
So the geometry generically will be adjusted by say, r to the sixth terms.
Okay.
The geometry will generically be adjusted. My claim is that the geometry is not really what you should ask. You should ask about the central charge. And my claim there, since it's an anomaly, and I've already gotten the exact answer, that will not be
okay,
adjusted.
Sorry, I didn't understand the question. Okay.
So what questions are you allowed to ask? I mean, now I have a solution. You've identified one thing, and you take it to be the right answer because it matches. So what other question? What else can I do with your black hole?
Well, I mean, strictly speaking, the only where this is really valid is for solutions that are not singular at the second derivative level. You're getting corrections to the entropy. So I can compute subleading corrections to any black hole that is regular at leading order. It's about singularities that I have very limited things to say. Naively, you would think I have nothing to say. So if I said I did this derivative expansion, now I'm going to tell you how I resolve singularities, you should chase me out of the room, because that doesn't make any sense. But ADS-CFT and some known facts are suggesting that we do have the right answer for certain questions about singularities. Basically, the only question we can answer is that it looks like this singularity is resolved.
Why do you say that? Sorry, I don't see how that matches the previous. If there are the six corrections, at least I might worry, well, those might be singular.
That should ruin the central charge then. Because if it's singular, I wouldn't have an ADS to calculate a central charge that excludes it. I mean, I can only calculate a central charge if there's an ADS. But there can't be an ADS if it's singular. So that I can compute a central charge at this order, I get the right answer.
I don't know. It's not clear how much of this fundamental, how much might be left.
That's fair. It's not clear to me either. I mean, this is fair. No, in some sense, maybe it is a little muff, but also there's a lot of symmetry. There's a nominal calculation. Maybe we can shore up the argument.
So what is the setup that you have in mind when you talk about it, when you flash this ABS5 thing in your last, second last?
What's the setup?
Yeah.
Could you be more specific? Do you mean microscopically?
So this is going to be asymptotically ABS5 plus S5.
Well, so this would be a five-dimensional solution that's just asymptotically ABS5.
And
gauge supergravity?
Yeah, it
has to be a gauge supergravity. So the solution that I, or the theory that I was looking at before, doesn't have any asymptotically ABS5 solutions.
Right.
But I can also construct the higher derivative terms in a gauge supergravity.
Right.
Well, not me, but the authors that I quoted and constructed the previous action also.
So when we lift it, it will be lifted to ADS plus CY Palladio. Is that right? Yeah.
I'm not quite clear what the microscopics would be. So first of all, this is only n equals 2 supersymmetry. So that would be more supersymmetry. So if you can embed this, say, in type 2B, it's probably something more like ADS5 times some Sasaki-Einstein manifold that doesn't have, that breaks some of the supersymmetry in the compactification. But it's not clear to me yet how I embed this in string theory. So I'm free, at this level, I'm free to do things at the supergravity, but it's not yet clear how this embeds into string theory.
If there are no further questions, let's hand it back.
Thank you.